From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Earlier this month, the Department of Justice sent what may be the most important memo in the history of for-profit prisons. Since the 90s, the Federal Bureau of Prisons has paid private companies to run some of its facilities. And this memo directs the Bureau to roll back and ultimately end that practice.
Yeah, it was a really big announcement, and actually one that very few people expected.
That's Seth Fried Wessler, reporter for the Investigative Fund. And before the memo came out, he spent 2 years digging into the Bureau's private prisons, exposing shoddy medical care.
And the prisons that I investigated are exactly the prisons that the Bureau of Prisons is going to start shutting down.
So being that you've been doing this work for so long, were you surprised by this?
I was incredibly surprised. I think there was a sense generally that the Bureau of Prisons might start to shut some of its private prisons, but that the Bureau of Prisons would have to stop using private prisons altogether. That was a very, very big surprise.
Because we're not just talking about a prison here and a prison there. We're talking about 13 contracts covering a dozen facilities housing 22,000 people. And almost all of those people are not U.S. citizens.
Few people know that the Bureau of Prisons have established this subsystem of federal private prisons used only to hold non-citizens.
The decision to wind this subsystem down came a week after a report from the Department of Justice's Inspector General. That report said these prisons don't really save money, and they have a higher rate of assaults, both on inmates and on staff. But before that report, Seth showed that the problems at these prisons go a lot deeper than that.
This is new at 10. An FBI affidavit details what happened during an almost 8-hour deadly riot.
Housing units set on fire. Inmates violently shaking the fence.
The inmate told us they want the public to know the reason they're doing this is because an inmate was sick and they don't believe he was given the proper medical care.
For years, these prisons have been rocked by riots, often rooted in complaints about medical negligence. And in partnership with Reveal, the Investigative Fund, and The Nation magazine, Seth exposed just how far that negligence went. Today, we're going to revisit that investigation with a new installment showing how, for the first time, top officials at the Bureau of Prisons protected failing facilities. But to start off, Reveal's Stan Alcorn joined Seth in Big Spring, Texas, a town on the edge of oil country, where one of these private prisons and a standard government-run prison sit side by side.
If you want to know what's going on inside a prison, you can't just walk in the front door and look around. But in the case of Big Spring's private federal prison, you can get a pretty good look at the soccer field. From the road, through a couple barbed wire fences, you can see men in khaki and white streaming out of a squat tan building, playing soccer, walking in pairs around the track. A short guy by the soccer goal is playing an accordion.
I've been looking into what happens in these prisons for years. This is the closest I've gotten to getting inside.
From here, Seth and I can see clues about what makes this prison different from the government-run prison next door. The inmates are mostly speaking Spanish. Again, they're all non-citizens. The sign out front says Geo Group Inc. That's the private company hired by the Federal Bureau of Prisons to run the place. But inside the prison, especially when it comes to medical care, the big difference is in the rules they have to follow.
Generally speaking, when prison experts talk about the Bureau of Prisons, they say that it's the best functioning prison system in the United States. But the kinds of rigorous policies that the Bureau of Prisons has developed to regulate staffing patterns and what kinds of workers do what in the provision of medical care, those rules aren't applied to the BOP's private prisons.
Seth wanted to find out how that affects patients, so he filed a public record request that got him over 9,000 pages of medical files and internal investigations, covering the entire 15-year history of these private prisons for non-citizens.
With handwritten notes from nurses and doctors, they're literally detailing minute by minute what's happening inside of medical clinics inside of these prisons.
Seth had doctors read all these files, and they found a pattern. Cases where lower standards and less qualified, less expensive workers came together to produce a medical disaster. Seth and I came to Big Spring to tell the story of one of those cases. But to understand what happened, it helps to start before things went wrong, when the guy in charge of healthcare was Dr. John Farquhar. Between 2010 and 2014, he was the one doctor for the more than 3,000 inmates.
Well, technically, I worked a 40-hour week, but you can't practice medicine on a 40-hour week. That's me.
Dr. Farquhar has rigid posture and a military haircut.
Hello.
And at 85 years old, he's still practicing medicine full-time, 7 days a week if he needs to.
I've always had a seven-day approach to medicine, and I didn't see anything unusual about that.
But he was unusual when compared to the other doctors in the prison medical files.
He was writing more notes than just about any other doctor in any of the other prisons. He was there all the time.
Whereas in other private prisons for non-citizens, medical notes were being written and medical decisions were being made by low-level medical workers, often licensed vocational nurses with only a year of training.
And then I started reading what he was writing.
Some of Dr. Farquhar's notes start normally by describing someone's symptoms or vital signs, but then they just go off, railing against his bosses, especially when they blocked him from transferring inmates out who were too sick to take care of in his limited prison clinic.
In one case, he wrote, "This man will almost certainly die." And that the Bureau of Prisons would, he wrote, "rush to find someone to blame, blithely ignoring the casual and repeated ways he has been dumped onto Big Spring."
There are times when I was critical. I'm a critical person, starting with myself.
You actually wrote at one point, "I feel bad for his shabby care."
Well, I stand by that statement. I don't know who it's about, and I can't comment on any single record of any person. But there are times when the care was not what I wanted for any patient, period.
He told us there was constant pressure to keep costs down. For instance, early on, his higher-ups told him to look at the number of times the prison had paid for an ambulance to take an inmate to the hospital.
They said, "You know, is there a way that we can cut this down?" And I said, "Probably yes."
I could imagine that could result in a pressure to not call when somebody really needs to go to the emergency room.
That's always the risk. That's why professional judgment takes professional training and professional experience, because you can't leave it up to anybody.
When Dr. Farquhar was clinical director, he was the one making those decisions. He was effectively always on call, and doctors who reviewed the medical files said he seemed to be doing as good a job as he could. But after 4 years, he said he was very tired, and he quit.
And then not long after he left the prison, there's a case that exhibits all of the problems that he was worried about.
The case of Nestor Garay. Back in 1998, when he was 25, Nestor came from Mexico City to wine country, Napa Valley, California.
It's beautiful here.
Where he moved in with his parents, Alvara and Indy.
Hola, ¿cómo está?
Seth and I visited them at their house, just a couple blocks from the natural food stores and bike shops of Main Street, St. Helena. When Nestor first moved here, he was like peas in a pod with his younger brother, Enrique.
They say when we answer the phone, we sound the same and we smile kind of the same.
They worked out at the gym together, and they worked together at the Sunshine Food Market. Nestor was in the cheese section. Enrique cut meat. But while Enrique went on to get a better job, buy his own house, and become a U.S. citizen, Nestor just stayed in the same bedroom in his parents' house.
He was very strongly attached to my mom and dad. Yeah, to be with them is like a pet. He wanted to be with them the whole time. But in a good way, because Nestor was a good son and all that, regardless of his addiction.
His addiction. It started with alcohol, but turned to meth. He started dealing to support his habit, sold to an undercover cop, and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. And because he'd never become a U.S. citizen, at 41, he ended up in the private GEO Group prison for non-citizens in Big Spring. His parents have stacks of letters Nestor sent them from prison, each of them with a hand-drawn and colored cartoon on the envelope. There's a jack-o'-lantern for Halloween, an orange cat with a bow on its head opening a gift for Christmas. His dad, Indy, opens one.
Nada más para saludarlos y decirles que todo está bien aquí en Texas.
The letter starts, "Just to say hello and tell you all is well in Texas." And then, early one Thursday morning, Indy told us they got a phone call.
Me llamaron sus amigos de él, compañeros.
It was Nestor's cellmates calling from inside the prison in Big Spring.
Una mala noticia.
With bad news.
Bueno, gracias por hablar conmigo,
Seth señor. Tracked down three of these cellmates, including Irineo Espinosa.
¿Con quién tengo el gusto? ¿Quién me habla?
Speaking by phone from Mexico, Irineo says it all started when he and the other men in the cell were asleep.
Como alguna, la mañana.
At 1 in the morning, Nestor starts moaning.
Ay, 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 sí, quejándose.
Irineo says Nestor is trying to speak, but he can only make signs with his hands. Irineo and the other cellmates carry him to a lower bunk and realize he's wet himself. They open the door and tell the guard outside that Nestor needs medical attention.
Llegó la enfermera como a la media hora.
Irineo says about a half hour later, a nurse arrives. It's licensed vocational nurse Gary Austin, the only medical professional at the prison that night. And it's his note that begins the medical file. It says, quote, upon arriving to inmate room, inmate lying on bottom bunk, looking straight ahead, but not responding to name. He writes that Nestor's sweaty. He has a weak grip on one side. And the cellmates think he's had a seizure. The cellmates are told to carry Nestor downstairs to the building's bare bones clinic. And there, instead of calling 911, Gary phones the physician assistant who's on call that night, Russell Amaru. Russell's at home asleep, but he wakes up and over the phone makes two key decisions. First, he tells the nurse to give Nestor Dilantin, an anti-seizure medication. And then, when Nestor can't swallow the pills, the notes show he gives a new order. Quote, send back to unit and place on mattress on floor. So the cellmates are asked to carry Nestor back upstairs. But Irineo says...
Dijimos no.
The cellmates said no.
No. Él necesita atención médica profesional.
He says he needs professional medical attention. Ask for a helicopter, an ambulance, that can take him to a clinic so he can get the care he needs. Ultimately, Nestor isn't returned to their cell. So the cellmates go to sleep thinking Nestor was taken to a hospital.
Y al día siguiente nos damos cuenta que qué fue lo que pasó.
Irineo says the next day they find out what happened.
Que lo llevaron a otra celda.
Nestor was just brought to another cell nearby and was left on a mattress on the floor until the morning shift arrived. By now, 5 hours have passed since Nestor started moaning, and he's transformed. He can't move his right side. His attempts to speak have become smacking sounds. The morning shift nurse, a more highly trained registered nurse, calls the prison's clinical director, a doctor, and they send Nestor to the nearest ER, where a CAT scan shows a massive stroke. He's then helicoptered to the Midland Memorial Hospital. We wanted to find out what happened to him there, so Seth and I went to the hospital and tracked down the neurologist who treated him that day.
Hi, doctor.
Hey.
How are you?
How are you?
Good.
Dr. John Foster.
If someone comes in having just had a massive ischemic stroke, how soon would they need to come in here for you to be able to do anything for them?
Would to be anything aggressive to them within 3 hours.
So as each hour passes...
Each minute, you have thousands of brain cells dying.
And if someone does come in 5 hours later, what can you do at that point?
For us, man, nothing.
Nestor's parents say the prison finally called them that afternoon, but they didn't tell them that Nestor had had a stroke, much less the details they'd heard hours earlier from the cellmates. So the next day, as they were preparing to fly to Texas, Nestor's dad, Indy, called the prison to get more information.
What was the capitan name?
His granddaughter recorded some of the call.
Do you know how long you're going to be here?
I don't know, not sure. It depends. You know, how is Nestor?
I haven't heard nothing today.
In the hospital, Nestor was shackled to the bed, and two prison guards were keeping watch when his family arrived. His dad, Indy, his brother, Enrique, and his mom, Alvara.
Me controlé, no quise gritar, no quise.
When we got there, I restrained myself. I didn't want to scream. I didn't want to yell because I really felt that my son could hear me. I didn't want him to hear me upset.
Yo recuerdo que lo abracé.
As soon as my mom started talking to Nestor, my mom hugged Nestor and Nestor cried. That's something I'm never going to forget. Somehow he was still there.
But the doctors told them that tear was just a reflex. Nestor was already gone. He was brain dead. His body was just being kept alive by the life support.
Fíjense qué crueldad.
I mean, look at the cruelty here. It wasn't until after they took him off life support that they took the shackles off.
Como que dijeron, si todavía vives.
It was as if they were saying, if you're still alive, then you're under my control.
The prison did its own internal review of what happened to Nestor Garay, and we got a copy. It found diagnosis was delayed, treatment was inappropriate, documentation was unacceptably incomplete. When Nestor didn't get better, the nurse or the physician assistant should have contacted the prison's doctor or top nurse. In other words, many things went wrong. But according to the four physicians we had independently review the medical file, the right thing to do was simple.
Call 911 is what he should have done.
That's neurologist Carolyn Martin.
If he had gotten there right away, he would have had a chance of survival. Not getting there right away, his chance of survival was really terrible. The prisoner was right, they should have called 911.
One reason they didn't call 911 could be the level of training of the only medical professional at the prison that night, Gary Austin. He's only a licensed vocational nurse, or LVN.
LVNs are essentially supervised, so they are not working independently.
Roberta Lavin is a nursing professor who used to work at a government-run federal prison. She says LVNs are usually supervised by a more highly trained registered nurse, while that higher-level nurse would know how to help someone with a gunshot wound, say. An LVN would help after they'd been stitched up, when it's time to give out the next dose of painkillers.
Or it's time to change that bandage.
She says to put LVNs alone on overnights at prisons, responding to emergencies, may save money, but it endangers inmates.
Having a person who has a more narrow scope of practice and is less prepared to deal with emergencies, what you're doing is you're putting barriers between that person who may have a medical emergency and the care.
You don't see this barrier to care in the government-run federal prisons. They have rules that specify what LVNs can do. But those rules don't apply to these private prisons. In a statement, GeoGroup said they strive to meet all the same standards, practices, and policies of government-run federal prisons. But after interviewing corrections officials and reviewing thousands of pages of medical files, Seth found something different.
We see over and over again, low-level medical workers, often licensed vocational nurses, are providing the bulk of medical care. Doctors who reviewed the files raised questions about whether those licensed vocational nurses were operating beyond the kind of care that they're trained to provide.
Seth got the medical files of 103 men who all died in these private federal prisons for non-citizens. And doctors who reviewed those files and additional evidence said 25 of those men likely died as a result of inadequate medical care that they got in prison.
One of these cases, a man named Claudio Fajardo Saucedo, was seen repeatedly, over and over again, complaining of headaches and back pain and nausea, and was only ever treated with ibuprofen and Tylenol and sent back to his bed. And he's nearly only seen by LVNs.
In fact, there's no record of him ever being sent to the prison doctor. After nearly 2 years of this, he's finally sent out to a hospital, where within days he dies of an AIDS-related brain infection. Doctors who reviewed the files said he should have been diagnosed with HIV long before. That case happened at another private prison for non-citizens, about 2 hours west of Big Spring, called Reeves. Last year, that prison was investigated by the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, a watchdog for the Bureau of Prisons. And we described Claudio's medical treatment and death to the Inspector General himself, Michael Horowitz.
It certainly doesn't surprise me what you're saying.
His review didn't look at the use of LVNs, but it did look at the number of total medical staff. And it found that in 34 out of 37 months, the prison had failed to meet the minimum required by its contract.
I think it raises two concerns. How does it impact individual inmates? And the second is, why was it happening for 34 out of 37 months? Why wasn't that caught before we showed up?
He's asking not just why this company was breaking the rules, but why the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which is supposed to enforce the rules, failed to notice any problems for 3 years straight. Since Nestor's death, his parents have kept his bedroom in their Napa Valley home the way he left it.
Bueno, en este cuarto les voy a ser honesta.
I'll be honest with you. We sleep in this room.
They sleep surrounded by Nestor's things.
Esta es su ropa de mi hijo.
His mom, Alvara, shows us Nestor's pants in the dresser. his hat on the door.
Me da tristeza por esto.
She picks up a pair of his gym shorts from the closet,
pero,
and smells them before she puts them back.
His clothes, I think we should get rid of it, give it to someone who needs it. But you want to keep him too?
That's Nestor's older brother, Carlos. And he wants to help his family move on. But he also wants to know why his brother wasn't taken to the hospital sooner.
I can make a list of people that were involved, but who's really responsible? Who's the boss? So I want an answer from the person who contracts these companies, and I want an answer from the warden.
The Federal Bureau of Prisons, which contracted GEO Group to run the prison, wouldn't agree to an interview and didn't respond to written questions. The GEO Group and its medical subcontractor, Correct Care Solutions, said because of privacy concerns, they were unable to comment on individual medical files. Gary Austin, the licensed vocational nurse who was at the prison that night, didn't return our messages. But Russell Amaru, the physician assistant who the medical file says gave the order over the phone to send Nestor back to his cell instead of a hospital.
Hi.
You Mr. Amaru?
I could be, and who are you?
Seth and I visited his house in a condo complex 40 minutes outside Big Spring, Texas.
Let me ask you guys a question. How'd you find out about me?
At first, he refused to speak with us.
You're not supposed to talk. That's one of the problems with the prison system.
But eventually, he led us into his kitchen and spoke for several hours because he wanted the world to know about all the other factors that he said prevented the medical staff at Big Spring from doing their jobs as well as they should.
There would have been a more aggressive care for that patient and other patients, too, if we had better training, better staff. It's just so many things are wrong there.
He explains the decisions he made the night Nestor died. Decisions doctors and the prison's own review said were wrong by pointing to a failure of communication. He says all the information he had was what he was told over the phone by Gary Austin, the licensed vocational nurse at the prison. Gary wrote in the file that Nestor was unresponsive and had a weak grip. But Russell says he was told something different.
He was up and communicating. It just, he was not real lucid.
And he pins that miscommunication on Gary's lack of training, the fact that he was an LVN, also called an LPN.
You had an LPN right out of school, new in corrections, trying to make an assessment. He did not have the skills. I don't blame them as the person. I blame the management system that puts him in that position.
It's easy to blame the person. And the four physicians who reviewed Nestor's file and the prison's own review did find fault with both Gary, the LVN, and Russell, the physician assistant. But if you blame only the person, you let the system that put them in that position off the hook. And the system that Russell describes is one that puts its staff and its inmates in a position that's always just one mistake away from a catastrophe.
Basically, what you have in essence is people that are undertrained doing jobs that they shouldn't be doing. We do not have an infirmary for 24-hour observation. Charts are often temporarily lost for a couple of days or a week or so. And so the companies that I work for, all the way up to BOP, they've got the model of how the place is supposed to be run, and they seem to allow it. And I know you want to ask me, what would I do to correct the problem? I'd close this whole facility down, and I'd start over again.
Closing the whole facility down seemed far-fetched when those words were first broadcast 6 months ago. But now, that's exactly what the Department of Justice is calling for all of these prisons. The contracts for Big Spring and Reeves are set to expire next year, and the Bureau of Prisons has been ordered to shrink the number of inmates in these facilities or shut them down for good. You can read investigative fund reporter Seth Fried Wessler's full investigation in The Nation magazine. And after the break, we'll hear from former federal officials who tried to keep these private prisons in line but found themselves being blocked by their own bosses. That's coming up next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey there, I'm Martin G. Reynolds, Reveal's Director of Investigative Fellowships, and I wanted to tell you about a new fellowship that we just launched. It's for journalists of color. Specifically, working journalists already employed by another media outlet or currently working freelance full-time. Throughout the year, our staff will work with the fellow to help them report and produce an investigative story. Fellows will be hooked up with all kinds of skills, training, coaching, and editing from mentors here in the Reveal newsroom. But the deadline for applications is coming quick. It's September 12th. So think about applying or help us spread the word. Go to revealnews.org/diversity to apply or to find out more. That's revealnews.org/diversity.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Before the break, we heard about people dying from inadequate medical care in private federal prisons. Now, the Department of Justice says it will start shutting them down. That's a complete 180 for the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Until now, it's given these companies a long leash. But as Investigative Fund reporter Seth Fried Wessler uncovered in a new investigation, it's not because they were ignorant of the problems. Seth got 20,000 new pages of internal reports that showed the Bureau of Prisons knew for years about serious healthcare failures, things like poor treatment for infectious diseases and not having enough medical staff. The reports even identified 34 inmates who died after getting substandard care. But it's how officials reacted that's really surprising. The clearest example is Adams County Correctional Center in Natchez, Mississippi. This is a promotional video put out by the company that runs the prison, the Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA.
Hi, I'm Vance Laughlin. I'm the warden at the Adams County Correctional Center.
In the video, the warden gives a prison tour to a lot of unsmiling men in CCA windbreakers and ties.
And you see, we got our investigator, assistant warden, assistant chief of security, and our maintenance supervisor.
These are all employees of CCA. But at the prison, there were also three employees of the federal government there to make sure that CCA was living up to its end of the contract. And Seth?
Can you just say your name and
he talked to one of them. There.
Donna Mott, and I retired after nearly 28 years with the Bureau of Prisons.
Donna Mott was at Adams County from the very beginning, working as an on-site monitor. Her job was to be the eyes of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, documenting problems and sending reports to her bosses back in Washington, D.C.
It's a matter of protecting the government. It's a matter of protecting the inmate. It was a matter of protecting my staff. I wanted my staff protected, that we documented it.
And right off the bat, after the prison opened, Donna Mott and the other monitors were finding systemic failures. Seth got their reports, and he says they show everything from violating state law by having nurses work unsupervised to not giving proper care for HIV.
6 months after that facility opened, monitors found dozens of deficiencies. They found that the whole medical system was failing to provide adequate care.
But identifying where the prison had fallen short didn't seem to change things.
When they came back 6 months later to check on the progress, many of those problems hadn't been fixed at all.
So why wasn't it getting fixed? Well, people like Donna, government officials on site at the prison, they were low in the bureaucracy. Whenever they found a problem, their protocol was to recommend finding the company. But when they sent it up the chain, Donna says her higher-ups in Washington would dramatically reduce the fines or not fine them at all. And she says that had consequences.
Every time we hit a contractor in the pocketbook, the problem got fixed. But if you have somebody from above pulling strings with give these guys a break, and you give them a break, they never take you seriously until something bad happens.
So in that case, what was the consequence?
Eventually, they had a full-scale riot.
This is new at 10. An FBI affidavit details what happened during an almost eight-hour deadly riot at the Adams County Correctional Facility.
At least five prison workers were sent to the hospital. One was killed in the mayhem.
The report shows hundreds of inmates were involved.
Their demands, better food, medical care, and guards who treat them well.
This riot in 2012, it got the attention of Donna Mott's higher-ups, all the way up to the top decision-makers at the Bureau of Prisons. But what happened next showed that there wasn't just a disconnect between those top officials and monitors in the prisons like Donna. There was a split between the top officials themselves. Seth found this out by talking to Doug Martz.
You can come on in. My office is in there.
Thank you.
I just got to get the guys going.
Doug Martz is out of the government now. But at the time, he was the federal official in charge of the Bureau's private prison contracts, a job that had the authority to renew a prison contract or shut the prison down. Seth met with Doug and asked him about the Adams County riot.
The prisoners said it was about treatment by guards or by administration, medical care and food. Do you see those things as being connected to what happened?
Yeah, I mean, obviously they were. You know, when you put all those together in one big picture and
it just became, you know, ignitable. I mean, if you feed them, you give them the adequate medical care, and you give them a safe place to be housed, you usually can run a facility without any problems.
After the riot, Doug decided Adams County wasn't worth the cost, so he worked up a proposal to end the prison's contract and shut it down. And he presented it to his boss, Bill Dalias, the CFO, or the head money guy at the Bureau of Prisons.
When our plan was presented to Mr. Dalias, it was met with a series of roadblocks and then a series of discussions. And, you know, we were never allowed to go forward with our plan. We were just asked for more and more information, more and more information.
It was delayed until it was too late. The prison stayed open. But the reason this happened, according to Doug, it's really kind of shocking. Doug told Seth he believes his boss, Bill Dalias, was being swayed by Harley Lappin, a top executive at CCA, the private prison company.
On various occasions when in Mr. Dalias' office, he would make reference to the fact that Harley called and said X. You know, why are we doing this?
Now, Harley Lappin wasn't just any private prison executive. He used to run the entire Bureau of Prisons, and he'd actually been Bill Dalias' boss.
And what Doug Martz was saying to me quite clearly is that these two people, who used to be very close colleagues at the Bureau of Prisons, continued talking to each other and continued to influence each other's decisions. And that's one of the reasons that Adams County wasn't shut down.
So, to recap, you've got the former head of the Bureau of Prisons working for a private company that he used to give contracts to, and he's allegedly calling up his old colleagues and influencing decisions affecting millions of dollars and thousands of prisoners. It's pretty much a textbook case of a revolving door between industry and regulators.
In fact, three former Bureau of Prisons directors have left the Bureau of Prisons and taken jobs or positions on the boards of the companies that run these prisons.
Not only that, but in late 2015, Bill Dalias, the guy Doug says kept Adams County open, he retired from the Bureau of Prisons. And 4 days later, he started a consulting company that does work for CCA, the private prison company. Seth asked Doug if he ever doubted what he was doing, sticking it out in his government job.
Maybe I can answer that in some ways by saying that I retired 2 weeks after my 25 years was up.
Why?
Because I, you know, there was a lot of stuff that ultimately that I just wasn't really comfortable with, you know.
Did you ever feel like you were just kind of filling a role that really you didn't actually get to do your job?
Absolutely. Yep.
After he retired, Doug did not take a lucrative job with a private prison company. He thinks that shouldn't be allowed. Instead, he started a franchise of Tailored Living, a company that builds garages and storage spaces. As for the Adams County Correctional Center, for now, it's still open.
After the riot and after this proposal to close it down, the contract was renewed for another 2 years. And last year, when monitors went and looked at what was happening, they found that in a single year, five inmates died in that prison after they'd been provided inadequate substandard medical care.
And Seth's investigation found that Adams County was far from the exception. At least 19 times in the past decade, the Federal Bureau of Prisons found serious and often repeated lapses in medical care at a private federal prison, and then decided to extend that prison's contract anyway. It's this pattern that's supposed to change with the Department of Justice's new decision to reduce and ultimately end every single one of these contracts. The Bureau of Prisons declined to answer a long list of detailed questions for this story. CCA didn't respond to an interview request, but in an email, they told us their executive, Harley Lappin, who used to be the director of the Bureau of Prisons, didn't break any federal ethics laws. They also said they're dedicated to providing consistent, high-quality health care in their prisons. You can read Investigative Fund reporter Seth Fried Wessler's full investigation in The Nation magazine. After the break, we turn to the question of where these prisons came from in the first place. It's a story of a major shift in criminal justice policy, and also the story of a father risking everything for his sons. That's coming up next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey, Reveal listeners, Julia B. Chan here. Recently, we tried something new. We rolled out an entire investigation on Instagram. If you missed it, check it out. will reveal news and the hashtag is #BadPleaDeals. Each post is a new chapter with a cool illustration. And the story is going to be up on our website this week, revealnews.org. But to read it chapter by chapter, go ahead and open up the Instagram app on your phone right now and find us. We're at Reveal News. And that hashtag is #BadPleaDeals.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. We're going to continue our investigation with Seth Fried Wessler of the Investigative Fund, who spent the last 2 years looking into private prisons that hold non-citizens convicted of federal crimes. The Department of Justice has just announced that it will phase these prisons out. Now we're going to turn to one reason why they were created in the first place, because this is probably the most surprising thing about these prisons. The most recent stats show that 40% of the more than 20,000 inmates are not there for robbery, fraud, or even drugs. They're serving time for the federal crime of illegally crossing the border. Now, most people caught crossing the border are not sent to prison. They're just deported. But criminal prosecution has been climbing through the Bush and Obama administrations. It's a part of a policy called enforcement with consequences. We're going to show you the change and the consequences by following one man who's lived it, Eloy Flores. Seth tracked him down, and he talked with him and Reveal's Stan Alcorn.
How many times do you think you've crossed total?
Maybe like 20 times or more.
So it's like almost once a year.
Yeah, pretty much once a year, two times a year.
To be clear, all these times he was crossing illegally. He never had an employer or a family member who could sponsor him for a green card. And so he says he never really tried.
To get a visa in Mexico, you got to be a rich man or get bank accounts and own houses and good jobs.
When Eloy first crossed, he said he never even had a job. He was a teenager looking to escape from the slow, violent divorce of his parents. And so, New Year's Eve, 1990, he and six other guys wade across the Rio Grande, naked.
Naked, yes. You got to get naked, and you got to get your clothes on top of your head. That way they don't get wet.
They get to the other side, Brownsville, Texas, dry off, put their clothes back on, and walk to a Kmart parking lot. There, they squeeze into the beat-up Mustang of Eloy's best friend. But then the car won't start.
So we got to get off the car and we got to push it, the car. And behind us, across a border patrol. And they didn't even pay attention to us. He just crossed by.
I mean, they could clearly see you?
We are in the road. But wait till I tell you another times I've crossed the border. This is nothing. From 1990 to 2005, I think it was the easy ones. From 2006 to today is really hard to cross the border, yeah.
The story of how it got hard is also the story of how those private prisons got filled. And it's also Eloy's story. It starts in that beat-up Mustang where Reveal's Stan Alcorn picks it up.
After they got the car started, Eloy and his best friend drove all the way from Brownsville, Texas to Silver Spring, Maryland. That's where Eloy got his first job, standing outside a 7-Eleven at dawn, waiting for contractors to pull up in their trucks looking for workers.
We are like 150 guys waiting for one truck or two trucks. You are lucky if you get a jump on the truck. Because if you're asking for a painter, everybody was a painter. If you're asking for a carpenter, we are a carpenter, 150 guys right there. So as soon as the truck show up, man, you got to be ready and you got to jump on the truck.
This is how he spent his first few years in Maryland, jumping into truck beds, digging holes, painting houses.
I had no holidays, no Christmas, nothing. No stop. Working every day. I was workaholic. Workaholic because I want to get better.
And his life did get better and better. He started his own painting company. He got married and had kids. He even bought a house in Baltimore County with woods in the backyard. And whenever he wanted to take a break, he'd just go to Mexico and then sneak back to the U.S.
Yeah, it was really easy. You can cross the border easy.
It was so easy, he did it once a year through the 90s. And then in 2008, he and his whole family went back for a few years. He wanted his four kids, who grew up in Maryland and are U.S. citizens, to experience their parents' country and learn their parents' language. Their stay in Mexico was supposed to end in 2011.
It was time to go back because all my children, they speak Spanish 100%. My older son is need to be go to the university. So it was time to go back.
Eloy and his wife planned to hire a human smuggler to help them cross the border, and then the kids would follow legally on a plane.
It was part of my plan, but I didn't make it because I find to cross the border is really, really hard.
In the 2 decades since he waded across the river to Brownsville, things had changed. The number of Border Patrol agents had increased fivefold, pushing the places to cross way out into the desert. Seth and I walked a tiny part of one of those routes in West Texas. It's a flat plain of sand and creosote bushes.
Was he by himself?
No.
This is roughly where Eloy and his wife were caught. Tracked down by footprints in the sand, they think. And then...
Security?
This is the Border Patrol station in Del Rio, Texas, where we walked through the process with spokesperson Enrique Vasquez.
And you're in our processing area.
Half the room is made up of holding cells, and the other half looks like a grim metallic version of airport passport control.
It's similar. They come up here, you interview them, you get their name, you get their basic information.
And then the agent sends almost every crosser to be criminally prosecuted for illegal entry. It's a program called Operation Streamline. It started here in Del Rio in 2005, but was soon adopted elsewhere on the border. To explain why it exists,
I'll let you step in on this.
He turns to Agent Joshua Spriggs from the Border Patrol's prosecution office, who says the idea is to create more of a deterrent than a simple deportation.
The desired outcome is that will affect them wanting to come back again illegally, meaning they know now if I go, they're just going to send me right back. Did it have the desired effect? Well, he's back again. So it didn't. So we need to try and find something else that maybe influences his decision to try and come back legally next time instead of crossing between the ports of entry.
And do you track that?
I'm sure we track everything. I mean, we have numbers for it. I don't have a number for you, but to say that it's effective, I would say yes.
The Border Patrol used to point to statistics showing that border crossers who were prosecuted were less likely to cross again. But they're now scrapping that measure because an agency watchdog pointed out they weren't checking if the effect lasted more than a year. Still, this policy of using the threat of prison time as a kind of psychological border wall, this is why Eloy and his wife were sent to federal court. This is a recording we got of the hour and a half in court for Eloy, his wife, and 82 other people charged with illegal entry. The voices you hear are from attorneys, a Spanish-English interpreter, and Magistrate Judge Victor Garcia. The defendants, who fill the jury box and even the benches for the public, are silent, except for the jingle of their chains.
And all of you, please stand up so I can give you the oath.
All the immigrants, we're looking around. Everybody's locked up from the ankles, knees, waist, and each other.
They're all wearing identical jumpsuits and what look like paper surgical masks over their mouths. Eloy says they could only see each other's eyes.
That's why we are like a numbers now. We're not person. We are numbers.
You are guaranteed a set of rights. You will be asked to waive them so that I can take your plea. These are your rights. Listen closely.
This is how the Streamline program works. In order to prosecute nearly every first-time crosser, nobody gets a separate proceeding. They're all processed as a group.
Yes or no, do you want to plead guilty today?
Courts have decided it would violate due process to have them answer questions in unison. So instead, the judge points to them one at a time.
Yes or no?
Which takes a little more than a minute per question.
Yes, by all.
Okay.
The one place where each individual gets attention is for sentencing, because the sentences depend on the defendant's criminal history, which usually means have they tried to cross the border before.
Mr. Calderona, you're going to be the first one of many that I have today that you have a conviction for illegal entry.
The more times someone's been caught and convicted for crossing in the past, the more jail time he gets this time.
You got 8 days the first time. You're getting 4 months the second time. It's up to 2 years the third time.
That's time he'll spend in a U.S. prison before being deported back to his home country. After a few cases, these sentences start to blend together.
Guilty or not guilty?
But for Eloy,
Mr. Fritz,
Judge Garcia decides to give a little speech.
You're not being prosecuted for being a bad person or because you do not have good reasons. Most of the people here, if not all of them, have very good reasons to cross, to work, to support their families, to better educate their kids, sometimes to pay off debts. The problem that you have, like all others, is you do not have permission to enter. But because you have a prior conviction, to be consistent and fair, the sentence I give you is because you have a prior conviction, not because you've done something wrong to the United States yet. You don't have permission to enter. So you got to do 4 months in prison. The only reason it's 4 months is because maybe after you do that long in prison, you will not return. I don't know that. I cannot stop you from coming back. But I can tell you what will happen if you do, and that you're going to be in prison. I know 4 months is a long time, considering you need to get back to your children. Your wife is here as well. But it's a lesson for everybody else that you cannot cross. Those days are over. You understand?
Yes.
Is there anything else you want to tell me?
No.
No. Thank you. Jesús García Franco.
Criminal prosecutions of border crossing have been on the rise since the 90s, when the Border Patrol started something called Prevention Through Deterrence. John Clausen became the head federal prosecutor in Midland, Texas, in the middle of all this, in 2003.
Illegal immigration was, I don't know if it was skyrocketing, but it was certainly on the upswing. And so there was a lot of discussion, well, how can we stop it or reduce it significantly? What are some things that we might try?
The Border Patrol got more funding and more agents. Operation Streamline started, prosecuting more first-time border crossers for illegal entry. And John says he was told by his superiors to prosecute as many people as he could for illegal re-entry, a felony charge for crossing after being deported. He says it was all kind of an experiment in discouraging not only the people sent to prison, but everyone they knew.
The idea is the word would spread, that they would go back to their home areas in Mexico and they would tell everybody else, man, it's not worth it.
More than 70,000 people were prosecuted in 2015 for immigration offenses. That's nearly twice as many as a decade ago. In fact, more people are now prosecuted for illegally crossing the border than all other categories of federal crime, drugs, weapons, white-collar crime, combined. But it's still only a fraction of the more than 300,000 people apprehended by Border Patrol each year.
And in general, why not prosecute everyone?
Because you can't possibly. I mean, if we were to prosecute every minute immigration offense, it would take up all of federal prosecutors' time, and we would not be able to devote our attention to other very serious criminal behavior which we're charged with addressing.
Okay, come in. Seth and I visited Atlacomulco, a small town north of Mexico City. It was supposed to be Eloy and his family's temporary home, but they've now been here for 8 years. Their main source of income is an internet cafe sandwiched between a tortilla factory and an office supply store.
Yeah, this is my own shop. I designed myself and I built everything you can see.
Eloy built little wooden cubicles with saloon doors for the computers. But when we visited, none of them were occupied. Eloy's oldest son, Eduardo, was manning the front desk.
Basically, we just take turns. Right now, it's my turn.
When he's not working, Eduardo's studying engineering at a local Mexican college. As a U.S. citizen, he could go to college in the States, but it would be a huge expense. And his parents are just scraping by as it is.
Right now, they're both here and we're happy, but happiness isn't helping us pay for food, paying for our school, our tuitions, because university is hard. Even here, it's hard, and I'm going to a public university.
All right, now let's go.
In 2 years, when Eduardo turns 21, he can sponsor his parents to get in line for a green card so they could get into the U.S. legally. But because of their history of illegally crossing and living in the U.S., they'd likely be barred from the country for 6 more years. And so even though Eloy spent 4 months in the private prison in Big Spring, Texas, he's talking about crossing again.
It's not for me anymore. Now it's for my sons. They are U.S. citizens. My older son, he always dreamed about study over there. So that's why I feel guilty because I fell in, not crossing the border.
Does the threat of being locked up in prison, does that make you think twice?
I make you think twice, but not stop it. Being locked up is only be slowed down. Sooner or later, we'll be there. I see a lot of friends, they're being locked up, spend 6 or 4 months, they're already in USA. So America is spending a lot of money. To give you a lesson, they don't work.
He told us there was a 50-50 chance he'd try to cross this year. And if he does, he figured there was a 90% chance he'd get caught, but a 10% chance he'd make it. It's like a lottery ticket, he said. If you win, you win. If you don't, you don't.
Since his story first aired, Aloy made another trip to the border, but he turned back at the last minute, not because of the threat of prison, but because his smuggler hadn't paid off the cartel and he decided it wasn't safe. The number of people who do cross, despite the risks, and then get caught, well, that number is down 70% over the last decade. But the biggest reason analysts point to isn't the threat of cartel violence or prison time. It's the economy. When there are fewer jobs, the United States is a lot less appealing. The prison where Aloy served time, it's one of the 13 the Justice Department's new ruling will eventually shut down. But more than 150 other private lockups will stay open under contracts with states and counties. They're run by the same companies and have many of the same problems. Next week, we continue our examination of private prisons through the experience of one employee guarding inmates on lockdown.
And they start threatening to riot. They're saying to us, if you don't let us out of here, we're going to put this prison on the news.
We revisit a groundbreaking investigation next week on Reveal. A huge thank you to Investigative Fund reporter Seth Fried Wessler for partnering with us this week. Stan Alcorn was our lead producer. Thanks to editor Esther Kaplan of the Investigative Fund. News footage of the Adams County riot came from WAPT in Jackson, Mississippi. Our sound design team is the Wonder Twins, my man, Jay Breezy and Claire C. Note Mullen. We had additional engineering help from Joe Plord. Our managing editor is Amy Pyle. Our head of studio is Krista Scharfenberg. Suzanne Reber is our executive editor, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveals provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.